4. Case sat in the loft with the dermatrodes strapped across his forehead, watching motes dance in the diluted sunlight that filtered through the grid overhead. A countdown was in progress in one corner of the monitor screen. Cowboys didn't get into SimStim, he thought, because it was basically a meat toy. He knew that the trodes he used and the little plastic tiara dangling from a SimStim deck were basically the same, and that the cyberspace matrix was actually a drastic simplification of the human sensorium, at least in terms of presentation. But SimStim itself struck him as a gratuitous multiplication of flesh input. The commercial stuff was edited, of course, so that if Tally Isham got a headache in the course of a segment, you didn't feel it. The screen bleeped a 2-second warning. The new switch was patched into his Sendai with a thin ribbon of fiber optics. And one, and two, and... Cyberspace slid into existence from the cardinal points. Smooth, he thought, but not smooth enough. Have to work on it. Then he keyed the new switch. The abrupt jolt into other flesh. Matrix gone. A wave of sound and color. She was moving through a crowded street, past stalls vending discount software, prices felt pinned on sheets of plastic, fragments of music from countless speakers, smells of urine, free monomers, perfume, patties of frying krill. For a few frightened seconds, he fought helplessly to control her body. Then he willed himself into passivity, became the passenger behind her eyes. The glasses didn't seem to cut down the sunlight at all. He wondered if the built-in amps compensated automatically. Blue alphanumerics winked the time, low in her left peripheral field. Showing off, he thought. Her body language was disorienting, her style foreign. She seemed continually on the verge of colliding with someone, but people melted out of her way, stepped sideways, made room. "How you doing, Case?" He heard the words and felt her form them. She slid a hand into her jacket, a fingertip circling a nipple under warm silk. The sensation made him catch his breath. She laughed, but the link was one way. He had no way to reply. 2 blocks later, she was threading the outskirts of Memory Lane. Case kept trying to jerk her eyes toward landmarks he would have used to find his way. He began to find the passivity of the situation irritating. The transition to cyberspace, when he hit the switch, was instantaneous. He punched himself down a wall of primitive ice belonging to the New York Public Library, automatically counting potential windows, keying back into her sensorium, into the sinuous flow of muscle, senses sharp and bright. He found himself wondering about the mind he shared these sensations with. What did he know about her? That she was another professional? That she said her being, like his, was the thing she did to make a living. He knew the way she'd moved against him earlier, when she woke, their mutual grunt of unity when he'd entered her, and that she liked her coffee black afterward. Her destination was one of the dubious software rental complexes that lined Memory Lane. There was a stillness, a hush. Booths lined a central hall. The clientele were young, few of them out of their teens. They all seemed to have carbon sockets planted behind the left ear, but she didn't focus on them. The counters that fronted the booths displayed hundreds of slivers of microsoft angular fragments of colored silicon mounted under oblong transparent bubbles on squares of white cardboard. Molly went to the 7th booth along the south wall. Behind the counter, a boy with a shaven head stared vacantly into space, a dozen spikes of microsoft protruding from the socket behind his ear. "Larry, you in, man?" She positioned herself in front of him. The boy's eyes focused. He sat up in his chair and pried a bright magenta splinter from his socket with a dirty thumbnail. "Hey, Larry." "Molly," he nodded. "I have some work for some of your friends, Larry." Larry took a flat plastic case from the pocket of his red sports shirt and flicked it open, slotting the microsoft beside a dozen others. His hand hovered, selected a glossy black chip that was slightly longer than the rest, and inserted it smoothly into his head. His eyes narrowed. "Molly's got a rider," he said. and Larry doesn't like that. Hey, she said, I didn't know you were so sensitive. I'm impressed. Costs a lot to get that sensitive. I know you, lady. The blank look returned. You looking to buy some softs? I'm looking for the moderns. You got a rider, Molly. This says, he tapped the black splinter, somebody else using your eyes. My partner. Tell your partner to go. Got something for the Panther moderns, Larry. What are you talking about, lady? Case, you take off, she said, and he hit the switch, instantly back in the matrix. Ghost impressions of the software complex hung for a few seconds in the buzzing calm of cyberspace. Panther moderns, he said to the Hosaka, removing the trodes. 5 minute précis. Ready, the computer said. It wasn't a name he knew. Something new, something that had come in since he'd been in Chiba. Fads swept the youth of the sprawl at the speed of light. Entire subcultures could rise overnight, thrive for a dozen weeks, and then vanish utterly. Go, he said. The Hosaka had accessed its array of libraries, journals, and news services. The précis began with a long hold on a color still that Case had first assumed was a collage of some kind, a boy's face snipped from another image and glued to a photograph of a paint-scrawled wall. Dark eyes, epicanthic folds obviously the result of surgery, an angry dusting of acne across pale narrow cheeks. The Hosaka released the freeze. The boy moved, flowing with the sinister grace of a mime pretending to be a jungle predator. His body was nearly invisible, an abstract pattern approximating the scribbled brickwork sliding smoothly across his tight one-piece. Mimetic polycarbon. Cut to Dr. Virginia Rambali, sociology, NYU. Her name, faculty, and school, pulsing across the screen in pink alphanumerics. Given their penchant for these random acts of surreal violence, someone said, it may be difficult for our viewers to understand why you continue to insist that this phenomenon isn't a form of terrorism. Dr. Rambali smiled. There is always a point at which the terrorist ceases to manipulate the media gestalt, a point at which the violence may well escalate, but beyond which the terrorist has become symptomatic of the media gestalt itself. Terrorism, as we ordinarily understand it, is innately media-related. The Panther moderns differ from other terrorists precisely in their degree of self-consciousness, in their awareness of the extent to which media divorce the act of terrorism from the original socio-political intent. Skip it, Case said. Case met his first modern 2 days after he'd screened the Hosaka's précis. The moderns, he'd decided, were a contemporary version of the big scientists of his own late teens. There was a kind of ghostly teenage DNA at work in the sprawl, something that carried the coded precepts of various short-lived subcults and replicated them at odd intervals. The Panther moderns were a soft-head variant on the scientists. If the technology had been available, the big scientists would all have had sockets stuffed with Microsofts. It was the style that mattered, and the style was the same. The moderns were mercenaries, practical jokers, nihilistic techno-fetishists. The one who showed up at the loft door with a box of diskettes from the Finn was a soft-voiced boy called Angelo. His face was a simple graft grown on collagen and shark cartilage polysaccharides, smooth and hideous. It was one of the nastiest pieces of elective surgery Case had ever seen. When Angelo smiled, revealing the razor-sharp canines of some large animal, Case was actually relieved. Tooth-bud transplants. He'd seen that before. You can't let the little prick's generation gap you, Molly said. Case nodded, absorbed in the patterns of the SenseNet ice. This was it. This was what he was, who he was, his being. He forgot to eat. Molly left cartons of rice and foam trays of sushi on the corner of the long table. Sometimes he resented having to leave the deck to use the chemical toilet they'd set up in a corner of the loft. Ice patterns formed and reformed on the screen as he probed for gaps, skirted the most obvious traps, and mapped the route he'd take through SenseNet's ice. It was good ice, wonderful ice. Its patterns burned there while he lay with his arm under Molly's shoulders, watching the red dawn through the steel grid of the skylight. Its rainbow pixel maze was the first thing he saw when he woke. He'd go straight to the deck, not bothering to dress, and jack in. He was cutting it. He was working. He lost track of days. And sometimes, falling asleep, particularly when Molly was off on one of her reconnaissance trips with her rented cadre of moderns, images of Chiba came flooding back. Faces and Ninsei neon. Once he woke from a confused dream of Linda Lee, unable to recall who she was or what she'd ever meant to him. When he did remember, he jacked in and worked for 9 straight hours. The cutting of SenseNet's ice took a total of 9 days. "I said a week," Armitage said, unable to conceal his satisfaction when Case showed him his plan for the run. "You took your own good time." "Balls," Case said, smiling at the screen. "That's good work, Armitage." "Yes," Armitage admitted. "But don't let it go to your head. Compared to what you'll eventually be up against, this is an arcade toy." "Love you, Cat Mother," whispered the Panther Modern's link man. His voice was modulated static in Case's headset. "Atlanta, Brood. Looks go. Go, got it?" Molly's voice was slightly clearer. "To hear is to obey." The moderns were using some kind of chicken wire dish in New Jersey to bounce the link man's scrambled signal off a Sons of Christ the King satellite in geosynchronous orbit above Manhattan. They chose to regard the entire operation as an elaborate private joke, and their choice of commsats seemed to have been deliberate. Molly's signals were being beamed up from a 1-meter umbrella dish, epoxied, to the roof of a black glass bank tower nearly as tall as the SenseNet building. Atlanta. The recognition code was simple. Atlanta, to Boston, to Chicago, to Denver. 5 minutes for each city. If anyone managed to intercept Molly's signal, unscramble it, synth her voice, the code would tip the moderns. If she remained in the building for more than 20 minutes, it was highly unlikely she'd be coming out at all. Case gulped the last of his coffee, settled the trodes in place, and scratched his chest beneath his black T-shirt. He had only a vague idea of what the Panther Moderns planned as a diversion for the SenseNet security people. His job was to make sure the intrusion program he'd written would link with the SenseNet systems when Molly needed it to. He watched the countdown in the corner of the screen. 2, 1. He jacked in and triggered his program. "Mainline," breathed the link man, his voice the only sound as Case plunged through the glowing strata of SenseNet ice. "Good. Check Molly." He hit the SimStim and flipped into her sensorium. The scrambler blurred the visual input slightly. She stood before a wall of gold-flecked mirror in the building's vast white lobby, chewing gum, apparently fascinated by her own reflection. Aside from the huge pair of sunglasses concealing her mirrored insets, she managed to look remarkably like she belonged there, another tourist girl hoping for a glimpse of Tally Isham. She wore a pink plastic raincoat, a white mesh top, loose white pants cut in a style that had been fashionable in Tokyo the previous year. She grinned vacantly and popped her gum. Case felt like laughing. He could feel the micropore tape across her rib cage, feel the flat little units under it, the radio, the SimStim unit, and the scrambler. The throat mic, glued to her neck, looked as much as possible like an analgesic dermadisc. Her hands, in the pockets of the pink coat, were flexing systematically through a series of tension-release exercises. It took him a few seconds to realize that the peculiar sensation at the tips of her fingers was caused by the blades as they were partially extruded, then retracted. He flipped back. His program had reached the 5th gate. He watched as his icebreaker strobed and shifted in front of him, only faintly aware of his hands playing across the deck, making minor adjustments. Translucent panes of color shuffled like a trick deck. "Take a card," he thought. "Any card." The gate blurred past. He laughed. The SenseNet ICE had accepted his entry as a routine transfer from the consortium's Los Angeles complex. He was inside. Behind him, viral subprograms peeled off, meshing with the gate's code fabric, ready to deflect the real Los Angeles data when it arrived. He flipped again. Molly was strolling past the enormous circular reception desk at the rear of the lobby. 12:01:20, as the readout flared in her optic nerve. At midnight, synced with the chip behind Molly's eye, the link man in New Jersey had given his command. Mainline. 9 moderns, scattered along 200 miles of the sprawl, had simultaneously dialed Max Emerge from payphones. Each modern delivered a short set speech, hung up, and drifted out into the night, peeling off surgical gloves. 9 different police departments and public security agencies were absorbing the information that an obscure subsect of militant Christian fundamentalists had just taken credit for having introduced clinical levels of an outlawed psychoactive agent known as Blue 9 into the ventilation system of the SenseNet pyramid. Blue 9, known in California as Grievous Angel, had been shown to produce acute paranoia and homicidal psychosis in 85% of experimental subjects. Case hit the switch as his program surged through the gates of the subsystem that controlled security for the SenseNet Research Library. He found himself stepping into an elevator. "Excuse me, but are you an employee?" The guard raised his eyebrows. Molly popped her gum. "No," she said, driving the first 2 knuckles of her right hand into the man's solar plexus. As he doubled over, clawing for the beeper on his belt, she slammed his head sideways against the wall of the elevator. Chewing a little more rapidly now, she touched close door and stop on the illuminated panel. She took a black box from her coat pocket and inserted a lead in the keyhole of the lock that secured the panel's circuitry. The Panther Moderns allowed 4 minutes for their first move to take effect, then injected a second carefully prepared dose of misinformation. This time they shot it directly into the SenseNet building's internal video system. At 12:04:03, every screen in the building strobed for 18 seconds in a frequency that produced seizures in a susceptible segment of SenseNet employees. Then something only vaguely like a human face filled the screens, its features stretched across asymmetrical expanses of bone like some obscene Mercator projection. Blue lips parted wetly as the twisted, elongated jaw moved. Something, perhaps a hand, a thing like a reddish clump of gnarled roots, fumbled toward the camera, blurred, and vanished. Subliminally rapid images of contamination, graphics of the building's water supply system, gloved hands manipulating laboratory glassware, something tumbling down into darkness, a pale splash. The audio track, its pitch adjusted to run at just less than twice the standard playback speed, was part of a month-old newscast detailing potential military uses of a substance known as HSG, a biochemical governing the human skeletal growth factor. Overdoses of HSG threw certain bone cells into overdrive, accelerating growth by factors as high as 1,000%. At 12:05:00, the mirror-sheathed nexus of the SenseNet Consortium held just over 3,000 employees. At 5 minutes after midnight, as the modern's message ended in a flare of white screen, the SenseNet pyramid screamed. 6 NYPD tactical hovercraft, responding to the possibility of Blue 9 in the building's ventilation system, were converging on the SenseNet pyramid. They were running full riot lights. A Bama rapid deployment helicopter was lifting off from its pad on Rikers. Case triggered his second program. A carefully engineered virus attacked the code fabric screening primary custodial commands for the sub-basement that housed the SenseNet research materials. "Boston," Molly's voice came across the link. "I'm downstairs." Case switched and saw the blank wall of the elevator. She was unzipping the white pants. A bulky packet, exactly the shade of her pale ankle, was secured there with micropore. She knelt and peeled the tape away. Streaks of burgundy flickered across the mimetic polycarbon as she unfolded the modern suit. She removed the pink raincoat, threw it down beside the white pants, and began to pull the suit on over the white mesh top. 12:06:26. Case's virus had bored a window through the library's command ice. He punched himself through and found an infinite blue space ranged with color-coded spheres strung on a tight grid of pale blue neon. In the non-space of the matrix, the interior of a given data construct possessed unlimited subjective dimension. A child's toy calculator, accessed through Case's Sendai, would have presented limitless gulfs of nothingness hung with a few basic commands. Case began to key the sequence the Finn had purchased from a mid-echelon Serari man with severe drug problems. He began to glide through the spheres as if he were on invisible tracks. Here, this one. Punching his way into the sphere, chill blue neon vault above him, starless and smooth as frosted glass, he triggered a subprogram that effected certain alterations in the core custodial commands. Out now. Reversing smoothly, the virus re-knitting the fabric of the window. Done. In the SenseNet lobby, two Panther Moderns sat alertly behind a low rectangular planter, taping the riot with a video camera. They both wore chameleon suits. Tacticals are spraying foam barricades now, one noted, speaking for the benefit of his throat mic. Rapids are still trying to land their copter. Case hit the SimStim switch and flipped into the agony of broken bone. Molly was braced against the blank gray wall of a long corridor, her breath coming ragged and uneven. Case was back in the matrix instantly, a white-hot line of pain fading in his left thigh. "What's happening, Brood?" he asked the link man. "I don't know, Cutter. Mother's not talking. Wait." Case's program was cycling. A single hair-fine thread of crimson neon extended from the center of the restored window to the shifting outline of his icebreaker. He didn't have time to wait. Taking a deep breath, he flipped again. Molly took a single step, trying to support her weight on the corridor wall. In the loft, Case groaned. The second step took her over an outstretched arm, uniform sleeve bright with fresh blood, glimpse of a shattered fiberglass shock stave. Her vision seemed to have narrowed to a tunnel. With the third step, Case screamed and found himself back in the matrix. "Brood? Boston, baby." Her voice tight with pain. She coughed. "Little problem with the natives. Think one of them broke my leg." "What you need now, Cat Mother?" The link man's voice was indistinct, nearly lost behind static. Case forced himself to flip back. She was leaning against the wall, taking all of her weight on her right leg. She fumbled through the contents of the suit's kangaroo pocket and withdrew a sheet of plastic studded with a rainbow of dermadiscs. She selected three and thumbed them hard against her left wrist, over the veins. 6,000 micrograms of endorphin analog came down on the pain like a hammer, shattering it. Her back arched convulsively. Pink waves of warmth lapped up her thighs. She sighed and slowly relaxed. "Okay, Brood. Okay now. But I'll need a medical team when I come out. Tell my people. Cutter, I'm 2 minutes from target. Can you hold?" "Tell her I'm in and holding," Case said. Molly began to limp down the corridor. When she glanced back once, Case saw the crumpled bodies of three SenseNet security guards. One of them seemed to have no eyes. "Tacticals and rapids have sealed the ground floor, Cat Mother. Foam barricades. Lobby's getting juicy." "Pretty juicy down here," she said, swinging herself through a pair of gray steel doors. "Almost there, Cutter." Case flipped into the matrix and pulled the trodes from his forehead. He was drenched with sweat. He wiped his forehead with a towel, took a quick sip of water from the bicycle bottle beside the Hosaka, and checked the map of the library displayed on the screen. A pulsing red cursor crept through the outline of a doorway. Only millimeters from the green dot that indicated the location of the Dixie Flatline's construct. He wondered what it was doing to her leg to walk on it that way. With enough endorphin analog, she could walk on a pair of bloody stumps. He tightened the nylon harness that held him in the chair and replaced the trodes. Routine now. Trodes, jack, and flip, The SenseNet Research Library was a dead storage area. The materials stored here had to be physically removed before they could be interfaced. Molly hobbled between rows of identical gray lockers. "Tell her 5 more and 10 to her left, Brood," Case said.
5 more and 10 left, Catmother," the link man said.
She took the left. A white-faced librarian cowered between 2 lockers, her cheeks wet, eyes blank. Molly ignored her. Case wondered what the moderns had done to provoke that level of terror. He knew it had something to do with a hoaxed threat, but he'd been too involved with his ice to follow Molly's explanation. "That's it," Case said, but she'd already stopped in front of the cabinet that held the construct. Its lines reminded Case of the Neo-Aztec bookcases in Julie Dean's anteroom in Chiba.
"Do it, Cutter," Molly said.
Case flipped to cyberspace and sent a command pulsing down the crimson thread that pierced the library ice. 5 separate alarm systems were convinced that they were still operative. The 3 elaborate locks deactivated, but considered themselves to have remained locked. The library's central bank suffered a minute shift in its permanent memory. The construct had been removed, per executive order, a month before. Checking for the authorization to remove the construct, a librarian would find the records erased. The door swung open on silent hinges.
0467839, Case said, and Molly drew a black storage unit from the rack. It resembled the magazine of a large assault rifle, its surfaces covered with warning decals and security ratings.
Molly closed the locker door. Case flipped. He withdrew the line through the library ice. It whipped back into his program, automatically triggering a full system reversal. The SenseNet gates snapped past him as he backed out, subprograms whirling back into the core of the icebreaker as he passed the gates where they had been stationed. "Out, Brood," he said, and slumped in his chair. After the concentration of an actual run, he could remain jacked in and still retain awareness of his body. It might take SenseNet days to discover the theft of the construct. The key would be the deflection of the Los Angeles transfer, which coincided too neatly with the modern's terror run. He doubted that the 3 security men Molly had encountered in the corridor would live to talk about it. He flipped. The elevator, with Molly's black box taped beside the control panel, remained where she'd left it. The guard still lay curled on the floor. Case noticed the derm on his neck for the first time, something of Molly's to keep him under. She stepped over him and removed the black box before punching lobby. As the elevator door hissed open, a woman hurtled backward out of the crowd into the elevator and struck the rear wall with her head. Molly ignored her, bending over to peel the derm from the guard's neck. Then she kicked the white pants and the pink raincoat out the door, tossing the dark glasses after them, and drew the hood of her suit down across her forehead. The construct, in the suit's kangaroo pocket, dug into her sternum when she moved. She stepped out. Case had seen panic before, but never in an enclosed area. The SenseNet employees, spilling out of the elevators, had surged for the street doors, only to meet the foam barricades of the tacticals and the sandbag guns of the Bama Rapids. The 2 agencies, convinced that they were containing a horde of potential killers, were cooperating with an uncharacteristic degree of efficiency. Beyond the shattered wreckage of the main street doors, bodies were piled 3 deep on the barricades. The hollow thumping of the riot guns provided a constant background for the sound the crowd made as it surged back and forth across the lobby's marble floor. Case had never heard anything like that sound. Neither, apparently, had Molly. "Jesus," she said and hesitated. It was a sort of keening, rising into a bubbling wail of raw and total fear. The lobby floor was covered with bodies, clothing, blood, and long trampled scrolls of yellow printout. "Come on, sister, we're for out." The eyes of the 2 moderns stared out of madly swirling shades of polycarbon, their suits unable to keep up with the confusion of shape and color that raged behind them. "You hurt? Come on, Tommy'll walk you." Tommy handed something to the one who spoke, a video camera wrapped in polycarbon. "Chicago," she said, "I'm on my way." And then she was falling. Not to the marble floor, slick with blood and vomit,
but down some blood-warm well, into silence and the dark. The Panther Modern leader, who introduced himself as Lupus Yonder Boy, wore a polycarbon suit with a recording feature that allowed him to replay backgrounds at will. Perched on the edge of Case's work table like some kind of state-of-the-art gargoyle, he regarded Case and Armitage with hooded eyes. He smiled. His hair was pink. A rainbow forest of Microsofts bristled behind his left ear. The ear was pointed, tufted with more pink hair. His pupils had been modified to catch the light like a cat's. Case watched the suit crawl with color and texture. "You let it get out of control," Armitage said. He stood in the center of the loft like a statue, wrapped in the dark glossy folds of an expensive-looking trench coat. "Chaos, Mr. Who," Lupus Yonder Boy said. "That is our mode and modus. That is our central kick. Your woman knows. We deal with her, not with you, Mr. Who." His suit had taken on a weird angular pattern of beige and pale avocado. "She needed her medical team. She's with them. We'll watch out for her. Everything's fine." He smiled again. "Pay him," Case said. Armitage glared at him. "We don't have the goods." "Your woman has it," Yonder Boy said. "Pay him." Armitage crossed stiffly to the table and took 3 fat bundles of new yen from the pockets of his trench coat. "You want to count it?" he asked Yonder Boy. "No," the Panther Modern said. "You'll pay. You're a Mr. Who. You pay to stay one, not a Mr. Name." "I hope that isn't a threat," Armitage said. "That's business," said Yonder Boy, stuffing the money into the single pocket on the front of his suit. The phone rang. Case answered. "Molly," he told Armitage, handing him the phone. The sprawl's geodesics were lightening into pre-dawn gray as Case left the building. His limbs felt cold and disconnected. He couldn't sleep. He was sick of the loft. Lupus had gone, then Armitage, and Molly was in surgery somewhere. Vibration beneath his feet as a train hissed past. Sirens dopplered in the distance. He took corners at random, his collar up, hunched in a new leather jacket, flicking the first of a chain of Yeheuans into the gutter and lighting another. He tried to imagine Armitage's toxin sacs dissolving in his bloodstream, microscopic membranes wearing thinner as he walked. It didn't seem real. Neither did the fear and agony he'd seen through Molly's eyes in the lobby of SenseNet. He found himself trying to remember the faces of the 3 people he'd killed in Chiba. The men were blanks. The woman reminded him of Linda Lee. A battered tricycle truck with mirrored windows bounced past him, empty plastic cylinders rattling in its bed. "Case." He darted sideways, instinctively getting a wall behind his back. "Message for you, Case." Lupus Yonder Boy's suit cycled through pure primaries. "Pardon, not to startle you." Case straightened up, hands in jacket pockets. He was a head taller than the Modern. "You ought to be careful, Yonder Boy." "This is the message. Wintermute. Wintermute. He spelled it out. "From you?" Case took a step forward. "No," Yonder Boy said. "For you."
"Who from?"
"Wintermute," Yonder Boy repeated, nodding, bobbing his crest of pink hair. His suit went matte black, a carbon shadow against old concrete. He executed a strange little dance, his thin black arms whirling, and then he was gone. "No, there." Hood up to hide the pink, the suit exactly the right shade of gray, mottled and stained as the sidewalk he stood on. The eyes winked back the red of a stoplight. And then he was really gone. Case closed his eyes, massaged them with numb fingers, leaning back against peeling brickwork. Ninsei had been a lot simpler.